One more.
Mr. Mike, it's up to you.
Chair. I know I'm...
Thank you, that was great.
See, that's what happens when you're pushing up against law.
Yeah.
Thank you for the record. Mike Sensi, Deputy Chief of the Portland Program. And with me today is Sergeant Eric Olson, who is as tired as he looks. So he got about 2 hours sleep because he was out chasing poachers all night.
Good arrest, though, I assure you.
He's also very heavily involved in what I'm here to talk to you guys today about. And there's numerous responsibilities that fit within our mission as a general authority officer with statewide jurisdiction. My hope today was to focus on the public safety aspect and how we fit into ensuring that the public is safe in the outdoors. And I think everybody's aware of the heinous acts that occurred in Paris, France. And the irony related to this presentation being heard in the aftermath of that probably isn't lost on anybody in this room. But our hearts and prayers to the victims and the families of that incredibly tragic event. Specifically, I'm going to touch on homeland and port security, natural disaster, critical incident response. And while the enforcement program has historically provided critical support during major incidents, over time, our role has expanded. We have a presence in homeland and port security, natural disaster response, critical incident response, for a number of reasons. Our role's expanded because our brand of law enforcement and operating area positions the agency really well in providing services where resources, law enforcement resources, are either thin or they just don't exist. And I don't know if y'all are aware that the deputy chief's position and the lieutenant's position out of headquarters actually represent the agency at the emergency management division. Our involvement provides support to that incident command structure. It's pretty critical support. And it's important to know that our contributions there have resulted in increasing the agency's value. It's resulted in increasing our relevance. And it's also opened the door to a lot of opportunity, including funding opportunity. So... while we are engaged in this public safety mission, oftentimes there's a mutual benefit to the agency's natural resource protection mission. And I hope that you'll be able to conclude that as well by the time we're done today. So to some degree, our capability to provide public safety services, it's naturally linked to the type of work that we do. And while being increasingly proficient is something that the agency, I think, is inherently good at, it inherently does. In this case, it's also a directive. There's a governor's directive in play that says basically that our agency shall identify personnel and equipment necessary to support swift water rescue and to be available as needed and requested by the adjunct general. You'll also find the agency mentioned in the Washington State All-Hazard Strategic Plan. And what that says is, what that plan directs is, develop necessary search and rescue resources and capabilities, including plans, equipment, training, and exercises. And again, you'll see the agency mentioned in the Washington State Comprehensive Emergency Management Plan, where we're mandated to provide personnel and equipment, such as commissioned officers, 4x4 vehicles and boats, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, I assume that means divers, and capabilities to support search and rescue. So here you see the program's Special Operations Group. It's comprised of several units. We have a swift water rescue team, which you see in the upper right. We have a marijuana prevention and eradication team who are also man trackers, or if the need arises, woman trackers, not gender specific, but they have the ability to find people. And they're seen in the bottom middle. And we have a dive team. The officers that form this team are tasked with addressing the habitat damage that's caused by industrial marijuana grows on public lands. And our approach is different than general law enforcement in that we try to keep the stuff from being planted in the first place. We get some pass-through funding for most of this activity, so somebody else is paying for additional time, our time in the field. And that pass-through money, though, is based on, frankly, a flawed model. The more plants you pull, the more money you get. So if you're highly effective, you sort of run yourself out of business. But again, we don't want the plants to go into the ground in the first place. We know that our object is to keep the habitat from being destroyed. We know that we don't want toxic chemicals, some of which are banned in the U.S., from being deployed in the water table. We know we don't want these live-in camps to take root and then have a deuce and a half worth of garbage, on our public lands. So there's consequences to the environment that I think everybody here recognizes, but less money at the end of the day. If we do business the way the funding model is constructed. So I'm going to have to find another way to sustain this program. By the way, Conservation Northwest actually funded $5,000 for a canine unit to help us safely navigate these grows. And that dog has been very successful in its role. But they understood the connection because we did a mapping scenario, and we determined that where all of our historical marijuana grows are also our designated sensitive species habitats. They overlap, primarily in eastern Washington.
Mike, do you know if Conservation Northwest has written that collaborative story up? Because that would be good to disseminate.
I don't think they have, but I think the willingness would be there. Mitch Friedman, is very, very aware of the importance of telling the story. They are, I think they're going to help us in the next session and future sessions in trying to obtain some funding for prevention work, not just simply eradication.
I think that's a story that should be shared.
I worked the hill pretty hard when all the marijuana bills were up, hoping that we could pull some tax dollars away. And folks are convinced that with legalization, that this is not going to be much of a problem. That's not our experience so far. We had just as much activity, if not more, over the last 2 years than we've ever seen. So this is not the only work they do. Members are also certified man trackers. And during a statewide skills event where they competed against some pretty high-speed GWIS SWAT teams and people tracking teams, they took the trophy home. And they beat the course in such record time they were accused of cheating. It took them they beat the course sooner than it took to set it up. So really an impressive level of skills here. You remember Margaret Anderson, the park ranger that was killed tragically. Fish and Wildlife Police officer actually identified the tracks that led to putting at least a period at the end of that tragedy and not having to wait till spring thaw to determine whether there was still someone at large or not. And there are many examples like that. So, unfortunately, we're all aware of this situation. Our 13-person Swiftwater Rescue Team is very capable of responding to rescue and recovery operations on moving water. They also conduct shore-based searches, and they're also equipped and trained to handle high-angle rope rescues. The team's typically deployed as a unit or two in a strike force fashion, and both motorized and paddle craft are strategically located throughout the state so we can rapidly deploy those if we have an incident, whether it's a flood or some other incident that requires us to deploy this capability. Washington State Parks is the boating law administrator for the state, and they provided the funds to equip these folks, so we really appreciate that partnership. This is a new addition to our program. The team's primary mission is to address significant challenges that we face in curtailing gooey duck poaching. It's not an activity that you can fully monitor above the water. You have to get under the water surface. But the team has merit in other areas that even I wasn't originally thinking about, like cutting lines out of our patrol vessel prop, locating a sunken barge a few weeks ago that was actually part of a significant hydraulics violation. And then there's, of course, the public safety function that you can imagine they can provide. And they've already been involved in some search and rescue and recovery missions.
Who certifies your dive team?
So we work very closely with the agency's master diver for the agency. We actually have to meet the commercial standard. And so we are. And I just want to understood that there's a real solid connection with the agency's dive board as well as the agency's dive master. But training and certifications have come from, in some cases, some of the members were cops for other agencies and had those expertise, and in other cases they were developed in-house. But training's ongoing.
I'm aware of one of the Marine officers, you know, up in Whatcom area, who's also a sniper for a SWAT team. How does that fit into this?
So maybe not as well as some of this other stuff. But it's very important that we network with other law enforcement programs. And we have a lot of common ground. What we do is policing. It's a special brand of policing. But oftentimes we need the assistance of other agencies. And when you provide a service that complements a tri-county area, such as that SWAT team in Whatcom County, you can count on those folks to assist you.
So is that common with our officers that they work around the state with other agencies in these sorts of emergency situations?
Yes, it is. When we rely on backup, you're not going to get it from another Fish and Wildlife officer, typically. You're going to get it from a county deputy. You're going to get it from a city officer. Frankly, a lot of the bad guys that we're chasing, they're involved in other criminal activity, you know, the hardcore group. And so, in fact, when I talked to you guys in December about the many shades of shellfish enforcement, what you're going to hear from me is that the typical hardcore shellfish poacher, I'm not talking about somebody going out and getting a few extra crabs. I'm talking about harvesting commercial quantities of bivalve product from polluted areas and marketing on all over the landscape. Many of those folks are into drugs. They're into drug dealing. They're into burglaries. And I could tell you countless stories about hardcore poachers being the county's problem as well. A very significant service that we provide is boating safety. Our patrol boats are not just ticket writing platforms. They're an additional layer of public safety or security where you can't call AAA if you need to bail out of trouble. We all know that getting into trouble on the Big Blue is not like getting a flat on I-5. And so we have the largest vessel fleet in the state. We spend more time on the water than any other local law enforcement. We do it at all times of the year and all kinds of conditions, so it makes sense that we're involved here. And State Parks, who administrates the program, they've been a solid partner. And they've funded a number of equipment and operational needs that the program would not have been able to afford otherwise. For example, we just met on a spending plan for 2016, and we received $170,000 from State Parks. That's what pays for things like our participation at Seafair. That's what pays for things like our participation during water follies in Tri-Cities. It also pays for the life jackets that you see our officers wearing and a lot of other equipment. So you know, that here's a little bit of a loose connection between boating safety and what we do as natural resource protectors. We had a shrimp fishery in Central Sound, and these two older gentlemen went down in a Boston Whaler, I believe it was a Boston Whaler, 28-foot, and Sergeant Olson helped get these individuals to safe harbor and also save their vessel, or at least get the vessel to some place where, you know, it could be dealt with. And interestingly, so these guys wanted the port to pull the boat out and dewater it, and it was going to cost too much. They were on a fixed income, so they decided to haul it to a shoreside residence there in the Sound and then work on it later. And a few weeks later, one of the gentlemen was in the Region 4 office, and he was complaining, doggone it, not only did my boat sink and I have this really horrible day, but my motor got stolen. Some rat fink stole my motor. And this guy is walking by as this fellow is talking to one of our biologists about, you know, this problem. And he goes, sir, what kind of motor was that? So the guy describes it. And the sergeant here says, hang on just a minute. What had happened is a suspect that he was chasing for commercial crab poaching close season actually stole that motor, and he watched it happen. He just didn't make the connection at the time.
It's actually one of my officers, yeah, who saw it, and that, that was putting those dots together was interesting, and these things are definitely connected, and it's kind of funny to see that full circle where you're like, wait a second, that was the guy that we were doing surveillance on, because I didn't see him steal the motor from the boat, but I saw the motor at the marina when he landed his product or his crab or shrimp, actually, I'm sorry. I remember him pulling this motor off the boat. I'm like, I got a great picture of it. And so I followed that truck to a parking lot. And then when he went into the store, I went up to the truck and took a picture of the outboard in the back of the truck. And I said, hold on, I'm going to show you something, because it looked a little odd to me. Guy goes out shrimping and comes back with an outboard they didn't leave with. So, yeah. Showed him a picture, and he says, what the hell? That's my motor! He was pretty pissed, but he's a real nice guy, super nice guy. And anyway, it's interesting. But, yeah, he's facing charges for those. So
you see the – thank you, Sarge. You see the stats here. We make a lot of contacts on the water. And while we're conducting boating safety inspections, we're also looking for AIS, and we conduct a lot of AIS inspections at the same time. We're heavily involved in the public safety aspect of this kind of natural event, sometimes not natural. When the east side was ablaze, our officers were working very closely with sheriff's offices And citizens are really indebted to this agency for our investment on this front. Just a quick side story. There were six engines headed to battle this fire, and just like out of the Wild West, these knuckleheads stopped the engines at gunpoint. Kind of constitutionalist type individuals threatened them not to pass. They didn't want the government, I guess, to save any homes, and that the fire crews were unable to do their job. So it was a Fish and Wildlife Police sergeant that took those men into custody and ensured that they answered that significant obstruction to public safety, because that sergeant was the only resource available to deal with that issue, and he was strategically located to do it. Yes, ma'am.
Are you in IC during fires? Is the department, and I'll just give a little background. It struck me with some of the fires that I've seen, and I think this may be, it has something to do with your concern, that it would be useful to have a department staff person in IC, maybe a biologist, as they're making decisions about where to deploy, and we could be involved with habitat protection ideas. You know, this is a high priority habitat, and if there's staff to deploy, could they be sent there? And I haven't seen that happens.
Well, we are at the EMD level, and which is, of course, you know, in contact with those incident commands. And so I'll say that there are situations where we have at both places, the incident command level as far and as well as EMD, but not all the time. But where we can afford that presence, where we're able to do that, it does make sense. And our the enforcement folks that participate in the EMD understand that the agency has far more capabilities than what just the little old enforcement program has. You know, we have heavy equipment and more vessels and people power and expertise. Sir.
And there again, Kim, you have a very valid point. We ended up in a really bad situation, and part of it was some other employees need to understand how the incident command works. There was a whole bunch of misunderstanding. Enforcement agents kind of got drug into it, but their better judgment slowed the whole thing down. But I guess if you assign new officers out into these rural areas, I would really recommend that they go around and meet the fire department. Because there again, this was part of that. Nobody had come to the fire meetings. I guess we should have invited them and got to know the people who they're working with, so it doesn't end up one of those them against us. Because we did end up eventually having some evacuation, and one of your officers was very heavily involved. But by that point in time, yeah.
And we thank you, sir. I appreciate that. We also have to be cognizant of the fact that the elected sheriff is the consummate law enforcement entity for respective county. And so oftentimes we take our direction from the sheriff's office as well. And so there's, you know, generally heavy coordination at that level.
Now, like you said, and I agree, Mike, but in these more rural areas, we just don't get deputies out there. We're going to have somebody out there, more than likely it is going to be a long fish and game officer. And this was one of those things that later I had our local warden come up, we sat down and talked, you know, and we got a whole bunch of things ironed out, that it would just been a lot better if we could have got it done before the fire. And
one of those things, you try and take a negative and turn it into a positive, and yes, going forward, let's do it this way.
You bet. We try to operate on the good, better, best principle. We'll never be the best. We do a decent job most of the time. Can always do better. I'm really proud of our staff relationship that they forge with other agencies. And just going to Chair Smith's comment a little bit, we do have a lot of relationships, and that includes other governments as well. We try to maximize areas of joint interests and then maximize our minimum financial and personnel resources via those working relationships. You know, it's not uncommon for our officers to work on a patrol vessel that's a Canadian flag patrol vessel, and vice versa. All the "don't wear a gun in my country" stuff doesn't really matter when you're in the Marine environment. And so there's a lot of really good exchanges there. So one of those relationships involves U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. We have contracts with that agency. They provide us some money to do Homeland Security patrols. And that partnership effectively increases Fish and Wildlife police officer presence in areas that we're going to patrol anyways, that we do patrol anyway. And it doesn't impact our budget. Somebody else is paying for that presence. You may not be aware of all the smuggling activity that occurs across public lands, but I'm here to tell you that there's a lot of it. So having this relationship not only leverages our program dollars, but our partners become more invested in assisting us with our primary mission at the same time. And there's a lot of overlap in that smugglers, for example, do use the cover of a legitimate outdoor activity. And so our officers are the subject matter experts when it comes to sorting out whether that activity is legitimate or not, and the federal government sees value in that.
Looks like Putin.
I can't tell you who that is, sir. It's top secret. So we also receive dollars from Customs and Border Protection for the marine environment as well. That you see here, our largest patrol vessel on the left, the Corliss, loaded with crab pots. Those are Canadian crab pots, and this operation was conducted jointly with U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. They used their resources because of the cross education that occurs and the partnership that we have. And I know Commissioner Mankin knows that when a foreign fishing vessel illegally enters our waters, that's a federal issue. And should Customs be concerned about that? Of course they should. When these vessels, Canadian vessels or foreign vessels, steal resources from our citizens, should our agency be concerned about that? Of course we should. So it's a make sense relationship, and frankly we'd be doing this kind of work anyway, but it'd be at a lesser level without the partnerships and the influence of dollars that we get through those partnerships. By the way, our entire vessel fleet fuel expense for all of our natural resource patrols in North Sound has been covered by the federal government for a number of years. The agency and the program isn't paying for that. Another entity is, because they see our value. They see value in investing in us. By the way, the vessel on the right is our newest addition, and that was also paid for by federal dollars. It did not come out of the program budget, and so that gives Chief Crown the ability to leverage program dollars to provide, for example, land presence or fill stations elsewhere.
And I heard you had a large part in obtaining that.
I'm only successful because of the good people that I support.
But I just wanted to throw the kudos out on that, because I was told by the good people that work for you about that.
That's right.
So I'm going to turn this over to Sergeant Olson. This is a program that he'll give you a quick overview about and link it up with how that's directly benefited this agency.
Well, I'm Eric Olson. I actually supervise the Central Puget Sound Marine Detachment. So that's basically Everett, Seattle, Tacoma right in there. So all those places where you always see a fish and wildlife officer, right? This started back in 2007. We were based on some credible intelligence that there was going to be possibly a some type of possible attack against some ports. The federal government wanted to increase their detection for what they call a dirty bomb, which is nuclear material wrapped around explosives, things of that nature. And because they believed it was going to come from a porous border for a maritime environment, they tasked the Domestic Nuclear Detection Office, commonly referred to as DNDO, to kind of run this particular program. And this was they basically went to every single marine law enforcement agency in the entire Puget Sound, and they came knocking on our door more through kind of word of mouth from other agencies saying, hey, Fish and Wildlife is out there. This is the statewide law enforcement agency on the water. And said, you know, you need to talk to these guys because we're out there doing the mission. Anyway, we're making these contacts. We're contacting fishermen, and we're in these ports, ports that they call what referred to as a tier one ports, which are ports that they consider to be a high risk of some attack. And all of the training that we do for this is about every 3 months. They basically send us through a one-day exercise where we're detecting radiation sources. We work with all these other marine law enforcement agencies, and it's all paid for by DNDO. It's all paid for by the feds at an overtime rate, so it's above our time that we would spend doing other activities. And it's I got to tell you, it's really, and they pay for all the equipment too. And I'll tell you, this is some phenomenally expensive equipment. Each one of those pieces of equipment is thousands of dollars. So, and they pay for it all, and they also pay for recalibrating the equipment too on a regular basis. So, none of it's paid for by our department. And again, since we're out there making these contacts, it really only makes sense, and it's really enhanced to our some of our relationships. The deputy chief talked a lot about leveraging those relationships with other law enforcement agencies, and I rely heavily on other, at least in the marine environment, other law enforcement agencies. They give me a lot of information about poaching that I wouldn't otherwise get a lot of times because they're out there. You know, and it's also actually given me the ability. You saw the picture of the Coast Guard helicopter. Well, that actually came through our participation in this program, where Coast Guard's heavily involved. They actually are one of the coordinators on this. And they said, hey, would you like to use one of our helicopters on them? I've utilized that helicopter and made more commercial gill netting, purse seining, close season shrimping cases. Because you can cover a lot of ground with a helicopter, and it is phenomenal. It doesn't cost us a dime, and it is awesome. And plus, I love riding in helicopters. It's a lot of fun. And having boats in place so we can respond and be able to cover a lot of ground, and we get some great cases. And that came from this program. And it's also given us that because of that, I don't know if you are familiar with the port security grants. I know we mentioned one of the grant programs from the feds there, the Stone Garden one. There's a port security grant that is that I actually helped write the grant for to be able to apply for some of this funding. Because we're out there, we're doing the job anyway, we're making the contacts, and we have this radiation detection equipment. Why can't we get some of that funding? Apparently three strikes and you're not out. Three strikes, we made it. It had to do, too, with the way they do the review on those grants at least the port security one, is it goes to the captain of the port. So the captain in charge of all the Coast Guard for Oregon and Washington and Idaho gets together, and they review all the grants. We were ranked, I don't know what our last ranking was, but the year before that we were ranked number two in the entire Puget Sound. We were ranked number two as the highest priority. We went to the national level, and they rank it nationally as well. So we got to Washington, D.C., and we got ranked down just because I don't think they really understood our capabilities, understood our the relationships that we have here, and we fixed that problem. We got the I talked to the director of the Domestic Nuclear Detection Office, very nice person, and she knew our capabilities. She knew how important we were in that environment, and she helped relay that message. And next time around, we had to have been ranked pretty high, because we ended up getting a $750,000 grant for a new patrol vessel. And it's pretty cool to see that kind of come to fruition after all that work. Because I tell you, I don't know if you guys ever written grants, but it's not fun. And they are thick. So that came from, again, those relationships. Because the captain of the port, again, knew what our capabilities, and knows what we can do and how important we are to that maritime environment. And then the next slide is the land-based one. So because of the success on the maritime environment, they've the Domestic Nuclear Detection Office has tried to put this into a land-based activity too, because, again, fish and wildlife, we are places where, especially up on the borders and stuff, in some very rural areas where no one else is. And they know that. And they also are highly impressed with my officers' capabilities, and I shouldn't say my officers, but our department's officers' capabilities. This is the entire Puget Sound. And they have invited our chief to be on the committee to what we call the steering committee, which is also the chief of the state patrol is on there. The head of the FBI for this region is on there. And because they're trying to push this out, because this threat is real. Every year they pay for someone to from our agency, and so far it's been me to go to the some place around the United States to be able to all the states get together and meet and talk about these threats. And again, it's paid all by DNDO, all the airfare, hotels, all that stuff is all paid for by them. And we talk about these threats. And I got to tell you, it's something that scares me a little bit, you know. So I'd love to be able to get this equipment into the hands of our officers and other officers too. You know, they're in these areas where this stuff might come through. And you can see right there. The next slide. But yeah, anyway, we're heavily involved in that. We're on all those committees and stuff that that are trying to get that pushed out. This is just a map of the really the tier one ports that we're talking about, and we have personnel in each one of these locations. And you know, when you look at this and say you are the captain of the port for the Coast Guard, you're going to look at this and you're going to go, that's a great investment. You know, they're out there, they're contacting fishermen, contacting boaters, they are the statewide law enforcement agency on the water. So let's fund them. And that's what we got this last time around, and it was pretty cool. So
the funding was just under $600,000, requires a state match, but we get a 300% return on our investment to build another patrol vessel, hasn't been built yet, to carry rad nuke detection equipment, just have it there. And it doesn't change anything in terms of how these folks conduct business. They just know that we're an asset, a detection asset, because of where we operate. So probably not the best characterization, but it's almost free money because of this agency's capability and presence. So we really rely to function and to focus on our primary mission on the investments of these other agencies. So that's all we have for you. Happy to take any questions.
Any questions?
Guys are hungry.
We're hungry, but as you were talking about this detection equipment, I guess it wouldn't be appropriate to explain exactly how you deploy it, but it seems to me what a huge challenge. Just a few pieces of equipment, a large environment to try to cover.
Well,
thank God you're doing this.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Very appreciative.
And it's not intrusive. It's just there.
Yeah.
It's just on our boat, and if there is a detection, the officer doesn't have to physically, wave something in the air and do all this stuff. It's there, and it detects it, just like Sergeant Olson, after training, driving down I-5 corridor, his belt unit goes off, and this elderly woman that had just gotten her elderly dog out of the vet's office from surgery, or it was a cat. Had a little radiation level that was so. I mean, he's like, this is not a jihadist that I'm next to. But I guess I better check.
She was, and you know what? Every single person we've ever contacted on that, because you end up getting some medical, hits, and you have to work through that. And every single person, without fail, and we've had a lot of hits over the years. Every single person is just like, oh, I'm so glad you're carrying that. I'm so glad you're here. And because we do a lot of inspections at the airport for exports of and imports of fish and wildlife, and we're there. And I tell you, they love the fact that we're carrying that stuff, because all it requires is turning an on button on when you're on patrol, and that's it.
Thanks, guys. I was really impressed last summer when I learned about the acquisition of the boat and the external funding opportunities. So, it's a double-edged sword. I was saying, we got to really get that message out. And then I said, well, we don't want too many legislators to know that message. Because, but I think it's a message that, that is you guys should be proud of that. And we're proud of you for doing that. So, thank you.
Thanks, sir.